All right, Judges 17 is where we are today. Judges 17, we looked at the first four or five verses last week, but we'll read that again because it will help to set the scene here. Judges chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, there was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursest and spakest of also in my ears, behold, the silver's with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, my son." And when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will restore it unto thee." Yet he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver, gave them to the founder, who made thereof a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a house of gods, and made an ephod and teraphim, and consecrated one of his sons, who became his priest. All right, so we looked at Micah's theft, his confession, his idols. We looked at that last week, and how your mother and mine would have responded differently, you know, had I confessed to a similar crime. But we left off with this idea here of Micah's imitation worship. You see there in verse number 5, the man Micah had a house of gods and made an ephod and teraphim. Now, the ephod, the word ephod means a robe. Okay, the priests, the multiple priests that served, they wore typically a white linen robe, white to represent purity, lack of defilement, that kind of thing. I'm probably not the only one who's ever wondered this, but my thought is, okay, you're dealing with the sacrifices. You're literally draining the blood out of animals and cutting the meat into portions that goes on the altar or goes here or there. What about those white linen robes? Who had to do the laundry on that, you know? But, you know, that was very common. But here when it says he made an ephod, it was probably not just a plain white robe that most of the priests would wear. More than likely, this refers to something similar to the ephod of the high priest. If you have ever studied the garments of the high priest, the high priest would wear a white robe, but then over top of that, there was a special robe. It was primarily a robe of blue, but it also had scarlet and gold and different colors in it. It actually had wires, gold that had been beaten into real thin plates, cut into wires. It would be woven through the fabric in different ways and such. On that ephod, there was the breastplate, 12 stones, one for each of the 12 tribes. In that breastplate was the Urim and Thummim, which was a method that they had of discerning yes, no answers from God. And so very ornate, very symbolic. But the fact that the breastplate and the Urim and Thummim had connections to how they would receive answers from God, that garment of the high priest, that ephod, came to be associated with getting answers from God because of the Urim and Thummim and so forth. You know, the ephod was like, okay, well, bring out bring out the objects by which we can commune with God. You know, that's very common in all forms of mythology and idolatry and false worship and all of that. But it's very interesting how often you see an ephod referenced in connection with false worships of different kinds. But it looks like he had something very similar to what was going on. Now, we looked at the map last time and said that, you know, Micah was a man of Ephraim, and Shiloh, where the tabernacle was set up, was in the territory of Ephraim. So if we're going to use our terminology, it was in the same county. Okay, it was in the vicinity. And yet he's setting up an imitation to mock the real thing, but you have the ephod, and then it says here you have teraphim. Now, what are the teraphim? Well, what we can say for sure is that appears to be one of the categories of angels. What do they look like? Well, I'll let Brother Love answer that. You can talk to him after Sunday school, okay? We don't know for sure, okay? There are descriptions of cherubim and seraphim and, you know, there's different things, but very likely that this was, some sort of image of something in the angelic realm. But what's interesting to me is, you have these images that show up all throughout the history of Israel. Do you remember when Jacob finally decided to make a run for it? He's like, Laban doesn't want anything to do with me anymore. And they made a run for it. When Laban caught up with him, he said, I didn't come to kill you, but why did you have to steal my idols, my images? Who stole them? Rachel, the favored wife, the younger sister there. But, if she stole them and then she could sit on them and hide them, then they weren't like life-size replicas, right? They were smaller in that instance. You remember when David had married Michal, the daughter of Saul, and then Saul's determined he's going to kill him. He sends soldiers to the house, and Michal meets him at the door and says, he's in the bed sick. I'm sorry he can't come. They go back and tell Saul, and Saul says, I don't care. Carry the whole bed in here. I want to kill him. When they went in there, what had Michal done? She had taken an image and laid it in the bed, to represent his body, covered it up, used a pillow of goat's hair to look like a head, to basically make it look like somebody was laying in the bed sick, They were all over the place. But here you have teraphim. So he had his, whatever the idol was that I think the graven work has to do with, it was carved out of wood. And then the molten idea is that it was overlaid with gold or silver. Or possibly a carved one and then one that had been melted down and poured into a mold. But then he has these teraphim that go with it. Why? Imitation. I mean, what do you have in every description in the Bible of, the dwelling place of God in heaven or the throne room of God in heaven? You have angels around that, right? In the tabernacle, if you go back and read the descriptions, I know reading Exodus and Leviticus isn't everybody's favorite section. If you're doing your read through the Bible in a year, I mean, I probably find it far more interesting than some people do. But one of the things that you find is the first layer of covering on the tabernacle, you had the walls on three sides. There were boards that would stand upright, and there were long poles or bars to stabilize it. They would stand in their own sockets on the ground. But then the first cloth layer that went over it was a cloth of scarlet and blue and purple and gold. And there were cherubims and seraphims and whatever. But there were angels woven into that. So when you look up in the tabernacle, you had the angels over, where God was going to meet with man. So you see that connection all over. You see in Isaiah chapter 6, the angels around the throne. You see in Ezekiel that Satan was called an anointed cherub that covereth. He was right there with the throne of God at one point before he was kicked out. So to have angels associated with the worship, I don't think is too much of a stretch. But here's interesting. I'm sure all of you have memorized this verse from Hosea chapter 3. Okay, maybe not. But here, for the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, without a prince, without sacrifice. That was a prophecy of their captivity as judgment. And we know that God sent prophet after prophet after prophet. And when Israel refused to repent, it's like, okay, you're going into captivity. And it was different stages of the captivity. But here, Hosea says they're going to have many days without a king, a prince, and a sacrifice. They're not going to be able to access their temple. But then the rest of the verse goes on to say, without an image, without an ephod, and without teraphim. That's kind of interesting. So I think the first part, the king, the prince, and the sacrifice, could refer to what God had set up. The rest of it refers to the idolatrous practices, the image, the ephod, the teraphim. Okay? My point is that there seems to be a connection between the teraphim and the idolatrous worship, and in some cases, divination. You look at the king of Babylon, you look at different instances where divination was practiced. But the point is, Micah is bringing all of this pagan accessorizing, if I can say it that way, into his own house of gods. All right, so now, verse 5, he has a house of gods with idols, an ephod to mimic the high priest, teraphim, like the idolatrous worship, you know, angels, that kind of thing. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Now, there had to be a priest, but what was God's instruction for that? Who in Israel, who was to be the priests? The descendants of Aaron specifically and the tribe of Levi more generally. He knew that, but he made one of his own sons the priest. So in the same county as Shiloh, where the true Levites and priests were serving, he sets up his own house of gods. All right. Now, in the end of the chapter, or in the rest of the chapter, we find a Levite. But before we discuss that, look at verse number 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which is right in his own eyes. You've heard that phrase before, haven't you? Every man did that which is right in his own eyes. In some cases, that describes the driving patterns on certain highways, right? Or, you know, we could apply it to a lot of cultural things. But you see it here in chapter 7. It's repeated again in the very last chapter of the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And I think it's right in the middle of this story about Micah and his imitation house of worship, you know, to kind of illustrate, look, when there was not strong leadership, this is the kind of stuff that happened. Okay? Now, in those days, there was no king in Israel. It could have just been written as kind of wishful thinking. It could have been written from a historical perspective, like later on when there was a king. But in those days, there was no king in Israel. What is the thought there or the implication? If there were a king in Israel, what might have happened or what might have been different? If there were a king, you know, what would be expected of the king? All right, Doc's giving me sign language. He's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, what had God, what was the penalty in the law of Moses for idolatry? It was a death penalty, right? I mean, the expectation is if there were a king who was trying to enforce the laws that God had given the nation of Israel, then they would have put a stop to this. It wouldn't have been allowed to continue. What this does show us is that there was not central leadership to put a quash to it. But let me ask you this. I mean, if this were your son, your cousin, your brother, your nephew, that's doing something like this, would you try to say something to him about it? I mean, I know you in this room well enough to say, I think there's many of you that would. You wouldn't just let it go. You'd say something about it. Especially when it's not a matter of personal interpretation or individual preferences. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, is it a white shirt on the platform or colored shirts, okay? That used to be a thing in fundamentalist circles, okay? Some people do it out of convenience now, but, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. How many thou shalt nots have been violated here? Thou shalt have no other gods before me, commandment number one. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Okay? When God gave Moses all the instructions for the incense and the sacrifices and the altar and the priesthood and all that, they were specifically told not to copy certain things too. Okay? So this is not a personal preference issue. This is a black and white thou shalt not issue. So my point is they didn't necessarily need to have a king in order for somebody to speak up and say, this shouldn't be happening in Israel, right? What about the Levites that were a few miles away at Shiloh, the priests? What about the high priest? You know, there were other people that could have spoken up and said something. But my point is not to condemn them, but rather to draw attention to that and then make an application to America. How is it that people in America are emboldened to do things that, you know, violate the law? People break laws and there's no consequences, right? How is it that over the last 30 years, things that used to be done in secret have now come into the public square? Okay? Whether it's, you know, immorality or, you know, the whole LGBT, however many other letters you want to, movement. Or, you know, so many things. I mean, I like a lot of the policies of our current president, not all of them. But can you imagine 40 years ago, the president, you know, swearing in front of a TV camera? Why does the president feel like that's okay? Because of the cultural rot, it's accepted, not protested, right? I'm just saying that if there were strong families and a strong worship, and you know, and it were the worship of God would have been as strong as it should have been, then there should have been others around them that should have stepped up and said something, put a stop to this. I mean, according to the law of Moses, did his father, his brother, you know, his neighbors, did they have a right to drag him in for a trial? Yeah, they did. Could somebody have dragged him in for a trial, and could he have been sentenced to a death of stoning or some other execution for idolatry? Absolutely. Why did he get away with this? Because it was already being tolerated so much in society that, if I can say it this way, the moral fibers of the society had deteriorated, so now this kind of thing is either promoted or it's at least like, well, yeah, that's the way it is now. I mean, I look at this and go, how in the world did somebody not speak up and say something? And then I'm like, okay, what do I need to speak up and say something about in our day to day? But there's no king in Israel. The hope there is that a king would enforce the law of God. Now, later on, when they got a king, how did that go? Did having a king guarantee that the laws of God would be followed? Nope. Not at all. Saul was a waste. David was the king God wanted him to have, did a good job. Solomon did a little bit of good and a whole lot of destructive things. You know, Solomon is the one that institutionalized idolatry in Israel. I mean, we blame Jeroboam for it, but Solomon built houses for his wives from Egypt and different places, built temples that lasted until the time of Hezekiah when he finally tore down some of the altars that Solomon had built 150, 200 years later. So, I mean, you get Solomon, who we appreciate for his wisdom, appreciate for the writing of scriptures and things like that, and yet he allowed the deterioration. Then you have the Rehoboam-Jeroboam split after that, and all the kings of the north after that followed the calves and the idolatry of Jeroboam. So did having a king guarantee godliness? No. It's an individual choice, all right? Well then, to make things worse, you see Micah's Levite, verse 6. We read that, verse 7. And there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place. Now, in verse 7, he says, he was out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah. Why is Judah repeated twice there? Because Bethlehem, Judah is given there Bethlehem in Judah, or Bethlehem of Judah, belonging to Judah. Okay? There were other towns known as Bethlehem, you know, just like if I say right now, Greenville. What am I talking about? Well, some of you think I'm talking about a town in South Carolina, about an hour and 10 minutes south of here. Could be talking about Greenville, North Carolina. It's about 4.5 hours east of here. Or Greenville, Tennessee. That's about, you know, 3 hours northwest of here. You know, there were Bible names of towns same way that they had to specify. So he was of the house of Judah, that was his family, but Bethlehem, Judah was his home area. Verse 8 says that he departed from Bethlehem, Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. Sojourn means to travel, to stay temporarily. So what does this mean? He wasn't happy with his circumstances, right? He didn't like where he was or didn't like his job or wasn't happy with all of, you know, his opportunities or whatever. So he decided to move around. Where did he go? Verse number 8, he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah as he journeyed. Now, you see this man coming to the house of Micah. In chapter 18, we see other travelers who stopped off at the house of Micah. So, I mean, we're not given an address. I can't tell you to put in this location in Google Maps and this will take you right to the house of Micah. But logic tells us that apparently Micah's house was accessible from one of the main travel routes, okay? Whether he had road frontage on the highway, as we would say it today, or whether, you know, it was just off. But, you know, there were main north-south travel routes in Israel. And it seems like he was near one of the main roads in that part of the country. And here the Levite ended up there. He came to the house of Micah. Verse 9, Micah said unto him, "Whence comest thou?" And he said unto him, "I'm a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I may find a place." Hey, who are you? Where are you from? What you doing? What are you up to? I mean, we do the same thing today, right? You meet somebody, you're trying to start a conversation. What's your name? Where are you from? What do you do? What brings you here? You're just striking up a conversation. And the man tells him, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem, Judah, and I'm trying to sojourn. I don't really know where I'm going. I'm looking for a place to land." Verse 10, Micah said unto him, "Dwell with me and be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year and a suit of apparel and thy victuals." So the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and he was unto him as one of his sons. Now, either he was very desperate, so room and board and a few shekels sounded like a better salary than what he had, or a shekel was worth more in that day than it was later on in New Testament times. Okay, but he offered him basically room and board, a new suit of clothes every year, and 10 shekels of silver. Now, how many shekels of silver had Micah stolen from his mom in the first part of the chapter? Wasn't it 1,100? Okay, so either he offered him a really low salary, or that was a whole lot of money. You know, like we talked about, if a shekel were a day's wage on average, it'd be 15 years' salary is what he had stolen from his mom. So anyway, he offered him a salary and a position, and he went in. Verse 11, the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man was unto him as one of his sons. Now, it's interesting. In verse 10, he said, "Dwell with me, and you will be a father and a priest." Verse 11 says he was like one of his sons. So, did he get to be a father? Now, obviously, the term father, there's a literal meaning, father of offspring, but also kind of the idea of a respected leader. So did he get to be a father, or was Micah still the head figure there? That's kind of interesting. I don't know that I can give you a definitive answer, but it says he became part of the family. Micah viewed him as one of his sons. And then notice this very superstitious statement here at the end of chapter 12. This blows my mind even more than the "God bless you, my son," when he confessed to his mom that he lied. Look at in verses 12 and 13. Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, "Now I know that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest." Verse 12 says he consecrated the Levite. What does that mean? They had a formal ceremony where he was given the title of priest. Now, what does that mean for his other son? Back in verse 5 it was, he consecrated one of his sons who became the priest. Well, now he's got a Levite. What, did his son get tired of it? Did his son not really want to do it? Does he now have two priests? Not much else is said about the son that was kind of, but here he set him, so we're going to have a special installation service. You know, we have a new priest here at the house of Micah. And so they had this formal ceremony, and he consecrated him, and he is now the priest of the house of Micah. All right, is any alarm bell going off in your head? Anything wrong with this? Now let me ask you this. Where did this Levite start? He started in Bethlehem, Judah. Okay, he was of that tribe where his family was there in Judah. But what should he have known? I mean, if he was a Levite, he should have been training, right? He should have known better. We have some, you know, retired pastors here, you know, that Brother Stevens, if somebody comes to you and says, you know, I got a church of 5,000 people, you got a salary of $250,000 a year, all you got to do is preach. We got staff for everything else. But, you know, we have a rock and roll band for our worship, and we use the, fill in the blank modern version of the Bible. And, we believe in just making people welcome and not really confronting sin. You going to take that position? I know that. You knew what he was going to say. The Levite should have known better too, right? The Levite got offered more prestige and more money to do something he knew he shouldn't have done. But he took it. I mean, our human nature, our sin nature is very real. I mean, that some of those temptations never change, right? Well, here, this Levite absolutely should have known better. He should have never agreed to that. But do you think maybe his discontent with his position of maybe he wasn't being promoted fast enough, or I'm a Levite, but I'm not a priest, you know, 10 years is a long time of training before I ever actually get to do anything. I mean, do you wonder if his discontent that caused him to sojourn made him jump at another opportunity that he shouldn't have taken? I do. But verse 13, Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest." Do you see all of the superstitious content in that statement right there? Who is he saying is expecting to bless him now? The Lord. Is that name in all caps in your Bible? All right, that tells us that's the proper name of God, right? I am that I am. The Lord, the name Jehovah or Yahweh. He says, now God is going to bless my house of idols. Hello? Anybody home? What's wrong with that statement? A lot. But God's going to bless me because now I have a Levite to be my priest. So he thinks that God is going to bless his house of idolatry because he has a Levite as the leader of his false worship. Okay, you know, I have a Baptist pastor as a leader of my cult now, so God's going to bless us. Makes no more sense than that, right? Makes no more sense than saying, you know, I am going to start a new business of selling cocaine, but I'm going to have a chaplain. I'm going to have a Baptist pastor as the chaplain of my business, and God's really going to bless my cocaine dealing because I have a Baptist pastor on my staff. Doesn't make any more sense than that, does it? God's going to bless me because I have a Levite to be the priest of my house of idols that God says is an abomination that deserves the death penalty. Now, what's the application for you and me? I don't think any of us has, you know, a graven image and a molten image and ephod and teraphim. But in Micah's mind, he came to the point where he could explain away and justify outright disobedience, right? The application for you and me is this. If we're not careful, we can explain away explicit disobedience to the Word of God, can't we? We can come up with a justification that at least makes sense in my head. You ever had something that made sense in your head and when you tried to say it out loud, it didn't make sense anymore? Yeah, we have that more often than we want to admit, right? But whether it must have made some kind of sense in his head, but when you say it out loud, when you write down what he did, it made absolutely no sense to expect God to bless this. May God deliver us from the self-delusion like Micah, of, yeah, I'm going to do this and God will bless this just because. You see in chapter 18, verse 1, in those days there was no king in Israel. Still repeating that theme. It's not exactly the same, but the idea is this. There was no central leadership. But does that mean that individuals shouldn't have done what was right? Micah should have done what was right. You know, the elders of the tribes should have been leading in that way. But this is, you know, right in line with the times of the judges. There's no central leadership. Everybody's just kind of doing their own thing. Micah should have known better. Micah talked himself into justifying what he really wanted to do. And, you know, the more and more that it feels like, you know, that those kinds of things are happening in our country, it ought to strengthen our resolve to say, whatever they're doing, we still have to do right. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, right? Like Joshua said. And this didn't have to happen. It did. Micah made a wrong decision. but it didn't have to happen. And I think that's the example for us. Now, we go on into chapter 18, and this Levite becomes the central figure in the next phase of the story. But we've got 3 minutes left till I'm supposed to be done anyway, so I think I'm going to stop right there. And we'll pick up that story in chapter 18 next time. May God help us to recognize before we forget to justifying things like Micah did. Let's